From Hawaii to Florida, New York to Texas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, American taxpayers are reaping benefits from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Protection Act. How much? The Heritage Foundation has a new interactive map that tells you. Adam Michelle of Heritage is here with details. President Trump is proposing $12 billion in subsidies for farmers hurt by the tariff trade war. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on why many farmers oppose the subsidy. The Supreme Court of the United States has ruled retailers do not have to have a presence in a state to be subjected to that state's sales taxes. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses fallout with Andrew Moylan of the National Taxpayers Union. And Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, sees the Trump administration's tariffs as another economic weapon that can be used to level the international trade playing field. He explains on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Millions of Americans are paying less in federal income taxes as a result of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed by Congress and signed into law last December by President Trump. Adam Michelle is a policy analyst with the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. They have a new interactive map that helps you find out how much less you are paying in taxes. He is here to tell us about it. Adam, welcome to American Radio Journal. Adam, before we get into exactly what the project is, this is being done in the aftermath of passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that occurred last December. So first of all, tell us what that Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is.
A lot of Americans still don't know that they got a significant tax cut last year. I guess it's this year. It was passed last year. So this year, 2018, the average American families across the board should see more money, should already be seeing more money in their paychecks because the federal government reduced tax rates for most Americans. They increased the standard deduction. They made some business reforms, all with the goal of making America more competitive and allowing us to keep more of our money and send less of it to Washington.
Congress actually got this passed, and so now it is perking through the economy. We've had 6 or 7 months for that to occur. The project to protect our paycheck. Tell us what that project is, undertaken, of course, by the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, we're really excited about this new project to protect our paycheck. It's an effort to educate people about the benefits of tax reform. We use IRS data, and for every single congressional district across the country, 435 different districts, we measure both the benefit this year in 2018 to the average taxpayer, and then we also look at what the benefit is over the next 10 years. And nationally, that looks like an additional $1,400 for American households this year, and more than $26,000 in increased take-home pay over the next 10 years because of tax reform. If you go to taxesandjobs.com, this is where the project is being hosted. You can actually click on your state and see your state information and then find your congressional district and get tailored results specifically for your community.
There was a lot of talk by those who opposed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that this was nothing more than a sop to big business, that the 1% would get richer, it wouldn't affect anybody else. Your research appears to directly contradict that, does it not?
Exactly. When we look at all the congressional districts across the country, we see that every single district gets a tax cut, every state gets a tax cut, and what we see even more incredibly is the lower income districts get the largest reduction in their income tax burdens as a percent of how much they were paying previously. Some of the lowest income districts in the country see 20 and 30% reductions in their income taxes. And that's what President Trump means when he says this is a tax cut for middle and low income Americans. He's talking about that huge reduction in how much folks are now sending to Washington after tax reform was passed.
Adam, walk us through the process. If I was sitting at my computer and I wanted to find out how this tax cut is affecting me, what would I do? Where would I go? Walk me step by step through it.
If you go to taxes and jobs, all one word and spelled out, taxesandjobs.com or to heritage.org, it's also hosted there. You will see a map of the United States. You just click on your state, and that will give you the sort of state statistics. And if you scroll down, you can select your congressional district. Click on that guy. You can do it by both number and the name of your representative in Congress. And then you'll be able to see both your average tax savings this year, what percent reduction that is in your taxes, and then what that looks like over the next 10 years when you include the economic growth that we project from the tax reform.
As you've done your studies with individuals getting this tax cut, are we seeing any increase in consumer spending?
Yes, we are. The last couple months, they've shown some small increases in consumer spending, and that's the more money in your pocket from the tax cuts. But I think even more impressive is all the statistics that we're seeing come out about how many jobs businesses are creating and how this is turning into more take-home pay, higher incomes for Americans across the country. We're currently in the longest running streak of businesses always adding new jobs to the economy rather than the number of jobs shrinking. And for the first time in our history, there are more jobs available than people looking for them. And this is if you look around, this is why you have started seeing help wanted signs pop up behind the counter and in the window when you walk into businesses across the nation.
As we look then at this expanding opportunity for people to be employed, is this something that is reserved for the more highly educated, the upper echelons, or is unemployment also falling and job opportunities growing for those who are maybe at either the lower end or the entry end of the spectrum?
The benefits are all the way across the board. The businesses that have been saying that they benefit the most from tax reform have been talking about raising their minimum wage to $15 an hour or more on their own without any government intervention. If you look at the sectors of the economy whose pay is rising the fastest, we're seeing that happen in retail, in construction. These are the industries that are benefiting the most from tax reform. And these are industries that employ everyday Americans. This is certainly not just a benefit for the sort of wealthy coastal elites.
Is Congress, Adam, considering any additional tax cuts?
There's talk right now here in Washington about tax cuts 2.0, and a big piece of that is making what we've already agreed on permanent. But they're also talking about new and innovative solutions to help Americans save more, both for retirement and for things like the next time your dishwasher breaks down or the next time you need to buy a new car. These are called universal savings accounts, which protect your savings from additional layers of taxation and simplify the tax code. And these are some of the ideas that are floating around out there for this sort of next round of tax reform that at least the House should be voting on in the next couple of months.
We have been talking with Adam Michelle, who is a policy analyst at the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Studies at the Heritage Foundation. We've been discussing the project to protect our paychecks. Adam, tell us a bit about the Heritage Foundation, where folks can go to learn more about Heritage, and also the website once again for the project.
The Heritage Foundation is a nonprofit here in Washington, D.C., and our mission is to look at and propose innovative policy solutions. You can find all of our research at heritage.org, and you can find this specific project at taxesandjobs.com.
Adam Michelle of the Heritage Foundation. Adam, thank you for taking time to be here.
Thanks for having me on.
Andy Roth is at the Club for Growth. It may be summer, but there are a lot of simmering issues before Congress. Andy, good to have you here to talk about it.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
We have a situation, Andy, where President Trump has decided to implement a number of tariffs, but this past week, he came up with a proposed subsidy to farmers who apparently are suffering because of the tariffs. What did the president propose?
This was a mistake, I think. The president proposed $12 billion basically in farm aid to the agriculture industry because when the president imposed tariffs on the EU and on China, those countries collectively all retaliated, and they naturally retaliated against one of our country's largest exports, which is agriculture. And so since the agriculture industry is getting harmed, Trump is trying to assuage them by providing them with some relief. And the way they're going to do that is they're going to dole out that $12 billion as direct payments, like they literally just cut them checks if these farms have excess product because they're unable to sell it overseas, then the federal government will buy it. And then a third way is that they'll just help this industry promote their products in other foreign markets. So those are the three ways that the Trump administration is going to help the industry. A couple of things I should point out. One is, what about all the non-agriculture industries? This is just government picking winners and losers again. Harley-Davidson and Whirlpool and other manufacturers are getting significantly harmed by these tariffs, but there's no aid for them. So I think it's pretty unjust. And two is, farm state senators and farmers themselves are not happy with this. They don't want what is basically welfare. One senator said that the Trump administration is putting the agriculture industry into the poorhouse and then giving them welfare. Well, they shouldn't have done any of that to begin with. So it's kind of a touchy subject. There's not a lot of happy people around, and it's just a frustrating thing right now.
Let's go to sort of the larger issue here, Andy, which is, when government at any level starts tinkering with the economy is such a Rubik's Cube that any action is going to have unintended consequences. Is this a case of, even though, as the president has put it, we've had our lunch eaten on these international agreements, that the whole issue of the federal government trying to direct the economy to begin with is not a winnable strategy?
It's certainly not good for the government to insert itself into the private economy, and that's what tariffs are. Tariffs are nothing but an earmark for a favored industry. The tariffs on steel and iron imports is basically an earmark for the domestic steel and iron industry. What everybody should be hoping for and rooting for are zero tariffs, zero subsidies, zero government intervention, both home and abroad. And President Trump has identified the problem correctly. There are other countries out there like China who are not living up to their agreed positions when it comes to trade. And so it's important that Trump combat that, but tariffs are the bad way of handling it. Tariffs are just taxes on ourselves. It doesn't really help solve the problem.
As we look at this issue then, Andrew, if we didn't do tariffs, what other course could possibly the president take? Renegotiate agreements? Would that be a possibility?
Right. So you basically have to resort to the hard tactic of strong diplomacy. And let's just take an example. The Chinese have been ripping off American companies' intellectual property rights for a long time. And that needs to get fixed. One way to do it is to impose tariffs, which will only make the Chinese stiffen their back and fight. A better way is to create a coalition of the willing. We talk about trade wars. Well, think of it as a war. The best way to get a country to concede and to change its ways is to build a coalition of other countries to fight against this country's bad behavior. Imagine a headline that says, Trump leads all of the major countries in calling on China to stop stealing intellectual property. But that's not what Trump's doing. Instead, he's fracturing his relationships with even his allies, like Mexico, Canada, and the EU. So I think a better course of action is for Trump to resolve all of the trade issues with its allies, come together, and then collectively go after China and say, listen, you need to clean up your house because we're upset, and together we are united against you, so fix your problem. That's a far better way of solving this than with tariffs that are directly harming American consumers and businesses. And if those tariffs continue and if more tariffs come, it will only make matters worse.
Let's talk for a minute about the European Union. The president of the European Union, or whatever's left of it these days, was in Washington, met with the president this past week. There was some talk about ultimately getting to a zero tariff policy on behalf of everyone. Is that something that we should take as sort of diplomatic nicety at the end of a summit, or is there a real possibility that we could get to that point?
Well, I'm certainly optimistic that we could get to a zero-zero tariff subsidy world, but I'm kind of skeptical. Whenever foreign leaders meet with each other, it's absolutely customary that at the conclusion of the meeting, they come out with some public agreement that they've made progress. And that's what exactly happened with Trump and the EU's Jean-Claude Juncker, who's kind of their top ambassador for this.
A complicated issue, and we are going, I'm sure, to be talking about it for many, many more months to come. Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, again, a couple of words about the Club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
When you make a purchase from an online retailer, you will now be paying your state's sales taxes. This as a result of a recent Supreme Court ruling. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks about the impact on taxpayers with Andrew Moylan of the National Taxpayers Union. Eric?
Well, it flew under the radar a little bit. It certainly wasn't the most exciting or the most highly anticipated Supreme Court ruling of this past year, but Wayfair v. South Dakota and what the Supreme Court decided in that case has the potential to really reshape state tax policy from coast to coast. And now Congress may be getting involved as well. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Andrew Moylan. He is a vice president at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. And he just this week testified in front of Congress as Congress tries to get their hands around the fallout from the Wayfair decision. And he joins us now to talk about that. Andrew, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Of course. My pleasure.
So before we get to what you said to Congress and what Congress may do, let's go back a little bit for people who may be unaware. Give us the background here in Wayfair. What was at stake in that Supreme Court case, and then what did the court say?
Yeah, it was very much a landmark decision. And basically, the background of this is that really for decades, states have attempted to enforce their tax obligations on businesses with no presence inside the state. And what has been holding them back from that was 25 years of Supreme Court precedent that said, no, you can't force your tax obligations on any business that isn't physically present in your borders. And that's a common sense protection, of course. But ultimately what happened is South Dakota didn't like this, and so they took it upon themselves to pass a law granting themselves the power to do this anyway. And then they were challenged all the way to the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, from my perspective, the court overturned its precedent and said, okay, states now can force their enforce their tax obligations outside their borders. And what it means is that states can have free rein, essentially, to force internet tax obligations on businesses all across the country.
Now, that precedent that you talked about, that is from a 1992 or 1993 decision. It was 25-some years ago, and it was a case that had to deal with catalog companies. I mean, you remember catalogs, right? When I was a kid, we used to order things through catalogs. Those don't exist anymore. The world has changed quite a bit in the last 25 years, at least when it comes to how we do our commerce when we're not going to a store. And so, I mean, that's kind of what the Supreme Court said here, is they said that, look, the world is totally different, and that's why it makes sense to overturn this 25-year-old precedent. That argument makes some sense to me because things are very different now than they were in the early 90s. Why is that flawed? What am I missing?
Well, I mean, that's obviously an argument that held sway with them. I think that it's overstated to a significant extent. If you look at it today, still 91% of retail sales take place in brick-and-mortar establishments. And so, yes, the internet is growing and it's expanding quite a bit, but it's still just 9% of sales. And even of those 9% of sales, the vast majority of those have tax collected on them already because they're made by big businesses that have physical presence everywhere. They're made by, you know, Amazon and Walmart and Best Buy and companies like that. So this is really, we're talking about a pretty small slice of sales and a pretty small slice of revenue, which is why I think that it's never really been about, can we get this little bit of pot of sales tax money. It's always been about trying to sort of undo limitations on state tax power and trying to remake the nature of limits on state tax power in the internet age. That's what the states have been over after for decades, and unfortunately the court gave them a lot of fuel for that fire.
We are talking with Andrew Moylan. He is with the National Taxpayers Union Foundation, and he's talking to us about the Wayfair Supreme Court decision and some of the fallout of that in state capitals and also in Congress. Andrew, you were in front of a House committee this week to give some testimony about Wayfair and about what Congress should do here. So the Supreme Court says, okay, state governments, you can start reaching across your borders to go after tax revenue for businesses, online businesses that are based elsewhere. What is Congress's role now? What should Congress be doing?
Well, and this is one of the rare instances where Congress actually has the sort of unquestioned ability to effectively overrule a Supreme Court decision. There are a lot of things Congress could do. What I was testifying to this week was to say, as a first step, I think we ought to have a moratorium so that we can have Congress have some time to deliberate on this and have businesses have some time to figure out what their obligations might be before states, which have already been moving very aggressively to sort of seize this new power that's been granted to them by the court, before they really make a mess of interstate commerce.
I guess one important way to think about this and to frame this debate is to think about, look, I'm somebody who really believes in federalism. I like the idea of every state being able to write their own policies, and some work and some don't, and that's kind of the beauty of the system. And at first blush, this Wayfair decision maybe looks like that sort of ruling, right? It says, all right, every state can make their own rules here. Some might decide to tax in this way. Others might not. But I think there's a bit of a problem with that logic here, and that is that if you've got states, literally, if you've got, you know, a South Dakota legislature reaching into New York or into California to grab tax revenue, that is literally interstate commerce. The Commerce Clause in the Constitution has been stretched beyond recognition in some ways, but this seems like a pretty clear example of where the federal government ultimately has the final say here. Congress has the final say here.
I'm a defender of and supporter of federalism. But, you know, this is the reason that the Commerce Clause was drafted. This is the reason that the founders recognized that the Articles of Confederation, which predated the Constitution, wasn't working, is that we had states really aggressively enforcing their power outside borders and doing it in a way that really harmed interstate commerce. And so that was one of the big reasons that we came together to draft the Constitution to allow Congress to ensure the free flow of interstate commerce. Now, yes, it has been bastardized in any number of ways, but this is one area where it makes sense to ensure that states are not really targeting businesses outside their borders, because there's nothing that a bureaucrat loves more than taxing somebody who can't vote them out of office. And ultimately, that's really what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think that probably sums it up pretty well. Being able to tax somebody who can't vote you out of office sounds like a politician's dream. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. We really appreciate you stopping by, Andrew. Thanks for taking some time being with us.
Of course. Thank you.
And that is Andrew Moylan. He is an executive vice president at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. You can check out their work on Wayfair and lots of other issues at ntu.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check us out at reason.com, and we'll be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Are President Trump's tariffs and the resulting trade war a good thing? Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, offers his take on the impact of tariffs on this American Radio Journal commentary.
President Trump's tariffs and trade policy have sparked extensive debate and heated arguments, both at home and abroad. The tariffs started with a 25% tariff on steel imports and a 10% tariff on aluminum. Retaliatory tariffs from our trading partners soon ensued. Since June 2018, the trade tariff salvos have continued and are now in the billions of dollars, with no one yet blinking. Tales of trade wars being started and world economic collapse following are being bantered about by critics of the president. It is clear that trade barriers such as tariffs can be problematic and should not be taken lightly. However, the U.S. balance of trade worldwide has been decidedly against the United States for decades, with devastating impact on the Rust Belt. What has propelled Donald Trump into the presidency is perhaps his decidedly clear understanding of the impact of this trade imbalance on the average American. The devastating reality to American workers of unfair trade barriers have been known for decades. In a 2010 article about Chinese trade barriers and tariffs against the United States showed substantial regulatory bias by the Chinese against the United States products, particularly in manufactured goods. Previous presidents have been unwilling to play the game of chess and brinkmanship that solves the trade problem, but instead caved into pressure to maintain the status quo. Trade policy was not an integral part of their negotiating posture, with rare exceptions since President Reagan. In economics, fiscal and monetary policies are mentioned as the two primary tools available to government to stabilize an economy. With his trade posturing, President Trump has opened up a third prong to the economic arsenal of policies available to the United States with his decidedly different approach to foreign trade than his predecessors. The conditions for this policy shift are perfect. The United States is at full employment. For the first time in recent history, there are more job openings than there are people looking for work. In the most recent unemployment statistics, the unemployment rate increased to 4%, but only because over 600,000 people re-entered the workforce and increasing the labor force participation rate. The inflation rate is still very manageable at approximately 2%. This rate of inflation is the Federal Reserve target and has sparked modest increase in interest rates. Quantitative easing, on the other hand, a program of monetary policy used during the Great Recession, peaked in 2014 and is starting to be paid back. Currently, however, there's still approximately $4.1 trillion of quantitative easing funds outstanding, down from the $4.5 trillion at the height of the program. These fiscal monetary policies had little material effect during the Great Recession, even despite such extensive intervention. President Trump's allure to the electorate was the realization that jobs, regulatory pressure hurting job growth, and foreign trade were the culprits. The electorate responded, and the strategy was set. This departure in policy by adding our trade policies into the arsenal of economic strength may possibly provide the world a substantially improved trading market with free trade truly being free. It is even possible that in the long run, prices for consumers may come down. Tariffs are in essence a tax and get paid to the government that imposes them. Concurrently, tariffs done in retaliation are paid by the consumer in the long run. The effect of these tariffs is to pay down the deficit while at the same time potentially cooling off the economy, which is at full employment. The strategic imposition of tariffs and trade policy can only be truly effective during a period of relatively full employment when the economy is able to absorb those workers temporarily dislocated from their jobs because of retaliatory tariffs. During any trade policy adjustment, great care must be taken to ensure that permanent damage to domestic industries does not occur. In essence, the president has added trade policy and tariffs as a fully functioning prong to the economic arsenal of weapons available to the United States to restore a balance of power and trade in the world. It is not without risk, and it is not without significant potential, long-lasting rewards. In the most recent past, only President Reagan was willing to engage in such strong jawboning negotiations with our international partners, and when he did, the Iron Curtain fell. President Trump's approach during a period of full employment as it relates to trade policies and tariffs is likely to be successful in restoring fair trade for the American worker and business. This parity in the international arena will yield continued economic growth. Such a growth rate assumes we will be able to transition our educational systems to graduate more students capable of handling the expanded growth. With trade policies, the president is able to exercise financial muscle as any CEO would do. With fiscal and monetary policy, the time lag of dealing with the legislature and the Federal Reserve to enact a policy shift is seldom, if ever, timely. Trade policy decisions and strategies are immediate. With President Trump's policy shift, free trade may truly become free. From the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WQSU-FM in Selins Grove, Pennsylvania, along with WBBC-FM and WKLV-AM in Blackstone, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.